Smith, here's a record by the Goofus Five and their enlarged orchestra. It was more than a five-piece band. Of course, it had Bill Moore on it, Adrian Rollini, and Red Nichols, and Irving Brodsky. Do you remember him?
Yeah, piano.
Yeah, he was a piano player.
Yeah.
And this one, the name of it is Deep Night. And according to Brian Rust, it was Seeger Ellis that did the vocal. And your name is on the record. And we want to play it and see. But you say you recall the record.
Yes.
Do you recall anything more of that particular session? It was February 28th, 1929.
No, I can't say that I do. I remember the names and the people and the tune itself.
Well, we'll play Deep Night, and then the flip side will be by the Dorsey Brothers.
Next, we come to a Columbia record. 2320 is the number. And the first side is Passing the Time with You. And the flip side will be You're Simply Delish. This again will be followed by another Columbia record, 2350. There's Something Missing in Your Eyes. And on the flip side, 9 Little Miles from 1010 Tennessee.
Do you remember any of the personnel on that 1010 Tennessee?
Yes, I do. And you remember, this is the number I made with Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
But this is my band, and there's an outstanding phrase and by one of my most favorite trumpet players, Manny Klein. Listen for it.
Okay.
Hello, collector friends. This is Olin Carver. I just wanted to mention here that this next selection is a record that Smith made with Art Kahn's orchestra on the old Mellotone label. The title, If You Were Only Mine. And if you listen closely, you'll hear Smith humming and singing along with the orchestra toward the end of this record.
Rhodes, you had a question you wanted to ask him.
Yes, I was curious to know whether the producer or the A&R man, as we'd call him today, requested you to sing in any particular key with the view in mind perhaps of competing with some other singer that your record company wanted to compete with. I mentioned that Seeger Ellis had that problem in trying to compete with Gene Austin.
No, I didn't. As a matter of fact, I don't know how to state the reason for my having done so many records, other than the fact that no special arrangement was required because I could sing in the original key of the song as it was written by the writer and as published by the publishing company. And in a lot of instances, other singers had to have things transposed into the key that was suitable for their voice. But I was fortunate in having a very wide range, not too good low and not too good high, but it covered practically all of the range of all the popular songs. So for that reason, if they had something that was a little difficult, I got into that mess too a couple of times. Once with Victor Young, with a Franz Lehár number that was a little beyond my scope, but he didn't think so, and he made me do it, and it turned out fairly well. But that's the real reason.
I see.
Smith, Rhodes asked me a question the other day when was talking about you. And I want him to ask you now. I told him we would when you got down here. It was the circumstances surrounding the Ellington recording. He was wondering.
I was wondering why you made the or what you had the vocal on the two sides that you cut with them. I just would like to know the circumstances of how you and the Ellington band got together on that date.
Well, that's very simple. I kept a record at home of all my dates. I mean, I had calls constantly from all companies, and I never was concerned with whom they were to be with or what bands were concerned. It didn't make any difference. I just knew that I had a date on such and such a day at such and such a studio, and I simply appeared. And when I appeared at Victor that morning, of course I knew the recording master very well, I walked by Studio A and looked in, and I said, well, this can't be where I'm going to work, because it's a bunch of colored guys in there.
Mm-hmm.
Must say colored today.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, well, they must have given me the wrong studio number. So I went up to the main office and talked to the recording master, and I said, where am I supposed to work? And he said, in Studio A. I'll take you down there.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked down there, and sure enough, that's what it was.
Yeah.
I had no idea who I was going to work with.
I see.
At the time the date was made.
What we was wondering, Smith, did your agent make arrangements with the date, probably with Irving Mills, who was managing Ellington? Is that why?
No. Irving Mills called my house and made the date. My wife put the date in the date book.
Oh.
I was too busy at night. I was working constantly. I didn't pay any attention to who the date might be. I simply appeared at the time that I was asked to be there.
Well, we were curious about how a band would go about getting a vocalist that had never worked with the band before to cut a record with them, see?
Well, they didn't always suggest anyone in particular. Depended on the studio they were working in, and the recording master would usually say, we'll put Scrappy Lambert on this, or Smith Ballou, or somebody else.
Oh, that's how it
goes. And they'd decide that, and I would get my call, and I'd simply go.
And he'd tell Ellington that we've got Ballou coming down for the vocal.
Sure.
That's what we was wondering about.
Oh, that's what
would what would the arrangement be financially on that? Would you get a flat fee, or would you ride on the royalty of the record?
No. In that day and time, there was no royalty contracts, really. Possibly some of the old-timers had royalty contracts who had a standard quantity of sales. Otherwise, they wouldn't make any money. Because this was during the period, as you know, that radio made terrific inroads into records, and records did not come back until about 1936 when they had the jukeboxes. So you had to be paid a reasonable amount for your services for that one service. And you would generally make more that way in the end than you would if you'd been on a royalty basis, because they didn't sell that many records at that time.
But if a record happened to sell...
Oh, that's something else.
If it did, you wouldn't get any
more. No, you'd get no more.
I see.
But they paid you well.
But at the same time, it'd make you more in demand.
That's true.
Yeah.
Are you ready? Well, if you...
What are we going to do now?
If you've got a royalty from all those records, you probably wouldn't be alive now, Smith.
No, I probably wouldn't.
Dinner is served.
Live to death.
Oh, it is.
What's that?
Yes, dinner is served.
Well, dinner is served. There's no more records at the moment, I'll tell you that.
We'll wait. Louise?
I'll be right back. I'm going.
Smith, looks like we've got some company after this nice dinner we had. Wonder if you'd introduce our company.
Oh, with pleasure. I particularly should like to introduce, first of all, Louise. And we want you to say something about it. Well, she hasn't had a chance to
I haven't
see what we're doing.
I haven't gotten warmed up yet.
You haven't gotten warmed up.
No, I don't quite know what to say.
By the way,
Mrs. Baker.
That's the title of your first record, isn't it? Louise? Or
one of
them.
Oh, did you
really
make Louise?
You made Louise.
A la Marie Chevalier.
I'm sorry. And then we have Mary.
Mrs. Deleuze. How do you do?
Well, I'm delighted to be here and to hear about the record business. I didn't know it was so tremendous.
I didn't either. If they fool me, I promise you.
Well, Smith, we're going to play the girls a record here. It's a vocal with the orchestra accompaniment. And who the orchestra is, you might listen to the record and have some idea. The name of it is My Fate Is in Your Hands. And I'll close my eyes.
Oh, my goodness. What terrific titles. It must be great.
See if you recognize any music.
Yes, I know them all, probably. They're the same ones that we use for solo records.
It's just Smith.
Pleasure Ferrara, trumpet.
You must have been getting big then, because they just put you down as a vocalist, no orchestra. Nothing.
Yes, well, this is a solo record for which I received, for your benefit, $1,000 a side. And I made three sides at a sitting.
Royalties, Smith?
No, no royalties.
Let's hear it, Harvey. Smith? Smith? We're going to put on some sides here, the same type that we just through playing, that contract you had with OK, I suppose.
Yes.
You made quite a few sides with them.
Yes, indeed I did. Solos, you're talking
about. With the studio orchestra coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we won't, no use giving these titles because the titles are on the record naturally.
That's right.
And we'll just put all of them on there we've got here.
Okay, got, I think that's a good idea.
About 12 sides.
I'm afraid it'll get a little bit tiring because of the slow tempo.
Well, if you get tired, you can take a walk. Mary and I'll sit and listen to them.
Okay.
Okay. Smith, this must have been a possible time in your career.
Well, it was. I didn't even know how much I was making. I didn't care, really. I was just busy working and
Did you have your orchestra at this time, or did
Sure. No, I had the orchestra, too. This was outside of the orchestra work.
Oh, you was busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many sides would you usually cut at this?
Well, solos were three sides.
Three sides
at
a time.
At a session, a three-hour session.
Well, these are good, and we enjoy them.
Well, I'm glad.
And now, while Smith and Tommy are taking a brief time out, here is a record that Smith made on the old Perfect label. The title, The Night Is Young, and the reverse, When I Go Too Old to Dream. Oh, now we come to a Mellotone record, number 350901. The title, What a Little Moonlight Can Do. Remember that one?
What's that?
And when you turn it over, you'll hear every single little tingle of my heart.
You remember those?
Yes, I do.
That's a good title.
Smith, we're going into some records now that were strictly studio recordings, I imagine, because the first one was called Dick Sherwin and his orchestra, and there really wasn't a Dick Sherwin, I don't think.
I certainly don't recognize the name, no.
And evidently they just picked out any name to put on some of them. However, you're listed on it as a vocal.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. It's on Romeo 1774.
Well, I should like to hear it.
Good Night Moon is the name.
Oh, no.
Here's one by Art Conn and his orchestra.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Mellotone.
Yes, I remember that one.
If You Were Only Mine. You were singing good last night on those mellotones.
Oh, yeah?
See how you are this morning.
Okay.
Do you recall Lou Gold? He was supposed to have been a recording contractor there.
Lou Gold, I recall very well, yes. And he used the best musicians available in New York at the time. And I don't recall this record.
Oh, it's really. An Oreo 2248.
Called That Little Boy of Mine, huh?
Well, I'd like to hear it.
The next one is a Romeo 1275 called Marta.
Oh, yes. I remember the old again. Yes, yes, I do. I remember Marta.
Well, we'll see.
That last one, you were good. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Smith is one by a gentleman that was a contractor that you remember, I know, Ed Kirkaby.
Oh, yeah, Eddie Kirkaby with his little Rex mustache, very dapper, but a much out of place person to my way of thinking. But he held his good standing with Columbia for years.
He hired a lot of musicians, didn't he?
That's true. He was really originally a manager of the
California Ramblers.
The California Ramblers, of course.
Yeah. Had the Dorseys on them. This one is on an Oriole 2462 in My Hideaway.
Oh, I recall that.
Smith, here's one that I think is a collector's item. It's on what was known as, still is, as Old Sears and Roebuck label.
Oh?
And no telling, of course, the name is a Swadian, Victor King and his Conqueror Orchestra.
My goodness, I never heard of that.
Well, they used somebody else's masters that you'd made.
With some other band. That is not the right name, I'm
no.
sure.
Rainbow Man was...
Rainbow Man. I don't recall that at all.
Oh, the gals probably thought you was that Rainbow Man. That, the way you're singing in those days.
I don't know.
Smith, here's another perfect record, 15453, by another studio group, Majestic Dance Orchestra, By My Side.
Well, I wonder who that can be now.
It seems like that on most of the perfect, they put your name as Buddy Blue.
Yep, that was one of the names that I had to use.
You're listed on this one as vocal by Buddy Blue.
No kidding.
So let's spin this one, Nolan. Smith, here's one of my favorite songs, Out of Nowhere.
Oh, yes, that was one of my favorites, too, and it's a beautiful song. I just hope I do it justice.
I hope so, too. Smith, here's a Columbia 1900, Am I Blue. You recall Ben Sullivan?
Yes, very well. Ben was with Columbia, Columbia Records. He had some title, and he's an officer there, and he did a lot of recording.
He got together some good groups.
Yes, he did. He had access to the best, and he used to use the best.
I imagine at the time you cut this, this was one of the most popular numbers there was.
It was quite popular. I'm sure he sold a lot of records, though I didn't get any benefit from it other than my little stipend for doing the vocal.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
Smith, here's one of my favorite records out of my collection. I might have stole it from Olin in days gone by, I don't know, but it's Joe Menuti and his New Yorkers, and they recorded in New York on February the 2nd, 1929, and I'd like to give the personnel on this.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that date, really. That's we had old Leo McConville, Buzzy Farrar, first trumpet, very fine, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, Jimmy Crossan on the alto, and Alfie.
Well, Smith, it looks like what we've got available here right now, that winds it up, and I can't think of a better. What amazes me, these last two numbers that we've played, how you could change your style. Now, both of those OKs were recorded approximately the same time.
Yeah.
Yet on Weary River, which was an entirely different type number than this last one, you was able to change your style to suit the song.
Well, I found that in many occasions that I had to get with the song, that's all. But I had a reputation I was very proud of in New York from the writers themselves. And they used to come around to White's restaurant where I was playing and bring their lead sheets to their newest creations. Some wonderful, really. And they always said that I seemed to have a natural way of wedding the lyrics to the song, to the melody. That I seemed to do it the way they would like to have it done, the way they wrote the song. And I thought that was a great compliment. I never told anybody that before.
Well, it is a good compliment because that way you were able to look at the different, these last 10 signs that we've played, look at the different style numbers that you did there and did all of them well.
From waltzes to melodies to blues. To rhythmic tunes, and I had a little trouble with the rhythmic things, though I'd always played a rhythm instrument and played it fairly well, so I was told. But I never particularly cared for that type of singing, rhythmic singing, other than Crosby, of course, but being his person by himself in that respect. He knows how to do a rhythm song so well.
You like the ballad?
Yes, that was really the kind that I preferred, and the things that I really could do my best job on.
Well, I like the ballad myself.
And now, Mr. Blue, if it's not imposing too much upon you, we'd like very much to have you sing a few bars of something just to close out this tape and make it even all the more interesting.
Well, I will attempt to get through, I think, an appropriate song now that we are parting. And that is, I'll see you again. And I hope I do.
Who'd you say arranged and played trumpet on this, Smith?
Oh, a guy. He's a friend of yours. You mentioned him tonight. And that brought him back to me. I never would have thought of the guy in my world. I would never thought of him again.
Jack what? Purvis.
Jack Purvis.
Well, look who came in. Smith, here's Seeger Ellis.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Smith. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good, Seeger. I'm managing to get around still.
Well, I'm hanging on myself.
How long has it been since you fellas seen each other?
Oh, I'd hate to say. Probably it's been 40 years.
I would think about that.
35 to 40 years.
That's in New York?
Yeah.
I believe that's the last place. Wasn't it
White's
Restaurant?
Yeah.
You played when you had your band playing in White's Restaurant?
We just played a record called White's Serenade.
And the club restaurant,
I sent you a fiddle player years ago with the name of Bruce Yantis.
We talked about him.
We called his brother.
Where is he? Do you know? Have any idea?
His brother last night said that he hadn't heard from him. Says never hears from him. And he was half asleep, and I didn't want to disturb him. I said, well, where is he? He says, he's either in New York or Chicago. I don't know where he is, really. But I haven't heard from him. I said, well, if you do hear from him, for goodness sake, tell him that I was asking about him. At least you're concerned about how he was doing. What had happened to him? He was a terrific violin player. He really was. A very emotional type of, I believe he was half Indian, wasn't he?
I believe so.
Yes, he Indian name.
He is a very fine violinist. I don't mean from the technical standpoint, or probably from the educational standpoint. But I thought that he was entirely next to Joe Venuti back in those days. He was more on the blues side.
Yeah,
I played more blues than Joe.
Played the low register.
Yeah,
what I call the
record. He had a sister
viola.
Here.
I mean, viola.
Yeah, he's on viola on one of the records.
He had a sister here, played organ, you remember
that?
Yes,
I heard it, but I remember
Seeger reminds me to meet a friend of ours, Olin Carver from Temple.
Oh, yeah.
Glad to meet you. Got quite a few of your records in my
collection. He's another collector here, this guy.
God bless these collectors. Keep these old cats alive.
Bless these old art
roads.
Come on, I was absolutely amazed. I got down to Temple through just a coincidence.
I found out about this guy.
Of course, this guy came in the back door. In the meantime, I mean, where he came from, he was cut out from under a twig or something.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we collectors are the ones that should be thankful for having you old time artists around that provided such wonderful music and vocals and all that.
I mean, that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
You bet. And they came up with things that I never would dream to ever find again, you know. I'd just given it up.
You know something, Smith? The same things happened to me.
Yeah, well, you...
They've come up with things that I didn't even... I'd forgotten I ever made.
Sure.
And how? Smith, a fellow wrote me the other... I had a letter the other day from a fellow in Wisconsin wanting to know if I would give him Seeger Ellis's address that he would like to write him.
No kidding. Yeah. From Wisconsin?
From Wisconsin.
He collects that record. Dig up, I don't know what.
Don't you think Seeger looks good for a newly married man?
Why, sure. He shows it.
Well, that's good. Well, we hate to close this tape out, but we're ending it on a happy note. And this is our guest of honor saying goodbye, Smith Ballou.
I'll see you again.
And another guest, Seeger Ellis.
Thank you very much, Smith. It's awfully good to see you.
Sure, nice to see you, Steve.
And the host, Rose Baker.
I'll see you myself again.
Harvey Hood, our engineer.
Yeah, boy.
Signing off. And Owen went to the... Here he is, Owen. We're signing off.
Well, it certainly has been a joy to me to be down here with all you fellows.
Myself, Tommy Boone, and our guest of honor... Smith Ballou, an orchestra leader and musician from way back, who incidentally was born in Palestine, Texas, in the year, he won't tell us the year, but whatever it is, he doesn't look it. He doesn't look like he's lived the life that he's bound to live. Anyway, here's Rhodes, I'm sure sorry you couldn't be here. Here's Smith.
How do you do? I'm amazed to find some records that the doctor then had ever made. As a matter of fact, I'm thrilled to find that these people are even interested in hearing my records. But I certainly am happy to be able to go back and pick up some of the old thoughts and old experiences that I had in the early days of record making in New York City. And I'm happy to be able to take them off on tape for posterity or whomever might be interested.
Smith, on the turntable now we've got I Want to Be Loved by Ellington. It was the time you made the two sides, 9 little miles from Tennessee. And this one, wonder if you'd tell us your surprise and how you come to cut those two records with Duke Ellington, and if you can recall what year.
Yes, I will. It was about 1930, somewhere around there, maybe 31. And I answered a call from Victor for a record date at some Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock. In room A at the Victor studio. Now, went to room A and looked in and found that the color was rather dark. The band was rather dark colored, I might say, and I thought perhaps being fresh from Texas, I was in the wrong place. So I went to the office and asked the recording master where I was to work, and he said, in room A. I'll take you down there, which he did. And sure enough, it was Duke Ellington and his band, and they were in the midst of making Mood Indigo, which is absolutely a record that stands alone. And I was so thrilled by it that before I knew it, I was very happy to be singing with Duke Ellington. And he, incidentally, is a great guy, and one that... should have all the honor he's received all these years.
Now we'll listen to this record, I Want to Be Loved.
The next number is the second number I did with Duke, called 9 Little Miles from 1010 Tennessee.
Smith, here, huh? Go ahead. What'd you say?
You might mention the beans on the
flip
side.
Here's some sides that were made with the Dorsey Brothers Orchestra in New York in 1928. The first one is on an English parlophone, She's Funny That Way. Incidentally, the flip has got the first vocal that Ben Crosby ever made. Do you remember working with the Dorseys at that time, or was it just a studio recording?
Well, actually, it was just a studio recording with the Dorsey Brothers' name on it and with some of the best musicians available at the time. Babe Russell? Perry Botkin on the guitar, yeah. Yes, they're all excellent musicians and a regular, what we call a studio date. But the orchestra was excellent. I'm sure you'll like it.
Had 3 unknown violins on there.
Just for you. Had 3 unknown ones?
Violins, yeah. They don't know their name, but they...
Oh, I see. They're just for me. I see.
That orchestra shut, yeah. Okay.
What are you playing next, Tom?
Another Dorsey Brothers, Sally of My Dreams and Crossroads. Do you remember this?
Sally of My Dreams and Crossroads. Well, no, I don't.
Well, let's see if you're on.
I doubt it.
Here's a real collector's item, Smith, that you recorded with Ben Pollock. And incidentally, it had Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, Jack Teagarden among the personnel. And it's interesting to note that the name of the vocalist is Charles Roberts. Wonder if you'd like to comment on the personnel and why you were going under the name of Charles Roberts. Were you wanted somewhere?
No, wasn't that at all. I have a brother named Charles Robert Ballou, and I had to have a name other than my name because I was under contract elsewhere. So I used Charles Roberts on this record. Incidentally, I played with Ben Pollock in Chicago at the Black Hawk Cafe before I went to New York. And that's more or less where I got started singing, really, with any important touch, because Ben was on WGN, I guess it was, in Chicago. And I did several vocals there and got started doing this and made quite a friendship with Glenn Miller, which is too long a story to tell here.
Well, was Goodman a regular with the band at that time?
Oh, indeed. He was indeed. This was before Ben, Vinny went off on his own.
This was recorded, supposedly, March the 1st, 1929.
Yeah, that's about right.
And I imagine Teagarden was a young, big strapper from Texas about that time.
He certainly was, yeah.
And do you remember Jimmy McPartin?
Very well. He played with me later in New Orleans.
Did you know his sister, Marion?
No, I didn't know her. But I knew his wife.
Gil Roden, did you know?
Oh, Gil I knew very well, of course.
Bud Freeman was also.
And Buddy Freeman, sure.
And I know you remember Al Beller on the violin.
Al Beller is the cousin of Ben Pollock. He always was in the band.
Well, I was.
Played second violin, by the way.
Your Dick Morgan was banjo and guitar.
Well, he took my place when I quit Ben Pollock.
Oh, he did?
Yes, he did.
When you quit as a musician?
Right? When I left Ben Pollock and went on to other... Well, to Teddy Fiorito,
yeah.
Frankly.
Oh, I see. Well, let's play Louise and be followed by the flip side.
Till you see Ma Cherie.
Smith, here's a record I've got that I'm certain you're on. It's the Ben Pollock Orchestra, and it was recorded on OK under the name Louisville Rhythm King.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, had Teagarden and Benny Goodman,
yeah.
The same group that recorded before,
uh-huh.
But under a different name because it was for OK.
That's right.
And my discography, Brian Russ, shows that You do the vocal on Let's Sit and Talk About You.
Well, let me hear it. I don't know when I did it, but I'd like to hear it.
We'll find out whether it was you or not.
Yeah, boss. Okay.
Yeah, let's play the flip side. Smith, this flip side has got a vocal trio, and it says that you're in the trio.
Well, it could be. You've got me. If I am, it's probably Hal Kemp's voice.
But that was you on the other
side. Oh, yes, indeed.
And on there was Joe Venuti, and I heard you say, you and Olin say that you're going to stop here a minute and get a little drink. I guess that was a little dram of coffee or something, but I imagine it was a little dram that what you said that Joe Venuti had a lot of trouble with.
Well, he didn't have too much trouble. I think his trouble was with vino red wine.
Italian,
you bet. Chianti.
Did Eddie Lang drink too?
No, I don't think he did at all. He was quite a very passive type of a person and very quiet, but tremendous musician.
Did he care a lot about Venuti?
Oh, they were very close. They stuck together on all occasions, and they stayed together on jobs, if they could possibly do it.
Well?
Because one was a compliment to the other, and, of course, there's no better, greater guitarist than Eddie Lang yet has ever come along.
It's a sad thing to think, though. There was Venuti, and I imagine he was lived kind of a harum-scarum, kind of a wild, carefree life.
Yeah.
And yet he outlived Eddie Lang, and still Eddie Lang died young.
Well, those kind always live longer, you know that.
Well, look at yourself, for instance. Interesting, at least it will be to me and others that hear this tape, as to how you got from Palestine, Texas, to a recording studio in New York. For instance, Studio A with Duke Ellington and some of the other great bands that you recorded with. And I know you didn't catch a train and walk up there and start recording. And so it'd be interesting if you'd tell us how you went there, and did you go there with the band or as a single or just what?
You're asking for a 1,000-word description. That goes on forever. My heavens. Of course I didn't walk out of Texas into New York and go and record. That's impossible. But to tell you how I arrived there would take much more time than we would bother the people to listen to.
Did you have a job when you went there?
Or yes and no. Yes and no. I got to New York. If you'd like to know how I got to New York, I'll tell you right quick. I went there with Ted Fiorito to a proposed radio job which never occurred, and Ted, being very wealthy, decided that, well, he'd try it another time. So there I was in New York. No job, no money, at Christmas time. I gave my wife a Hershey bar for a Christmas present. I simply picked up my instruments and went out on Broadway and 49th Street and stood there until somebody hired me.
Was it an almond bar or plain?
No, it was almond. I got almond anyway. No, it was quite a long story. I wouldn't like to bore anybody with. However, I was lucky and was fortunate. I had a desire to be successful, and the first opportunity to sing, I realized was my chance. Though I was a very fine instrumentalist, by the way. I played with some of the greatest bands in the country. But they weren't concerned with that. They were most concerned about singing, about whether I could sing or not. And I walked into the OK studio,
We had had several night sessions where we played all night, jam sessions, with the... I won't even try to name them all, but the Dorsey Brothers and Dick McDonough and several other people. And I sang, and they thought that I was the greatest, one of those things. Well, I didn't think so. But they took me down to OK, and we made a test. And from that, we went into and did the collector's item now, which was It a Dream, a two-side record. And that cinched my contract in New York.
Was It a Dream? Was that on the OK label?
It was on the OK label.
What orchestra?
It was titled Dorsey Brothers Orchestra, Two Sides, a 10-inch record. But it was actually conducted by Gene Golkett. But it was all the top men in New York with Whiteman's arranger. I can't say it. Crozier made the arrangement.
Well, Rube Crozier, was that?
Yes. Yeah.
At that time, I imagine Golkett was under contract to Victor, and he couldn't have put his name on an OK record anyway, could he?
Well, I don't think that was the plan back of it. They just had a great arrangement, and they had the Dorsey Brothers that they could use their name. They were big from the standpoint of selling records to the public.
Do you recall your first radio show in New York?
No, I really don't. Well, yes, I do, too, because that had a lot to do with it, too. I finally got into the first top call for all of the Myra Davis work, which was all the social work and all the society dances and debutantes parties and so forth, but Pierre's and so and other places. And they put me down into the Astor Hotel with a small combination, just playing and singing. And I even sang on the floor, but I told them before I would go on the radio, or I'd sing on the radio, that my name must be announced, that must be known that I was the one that was doing the singing, to say the least. And they agreed to that, and that's where NBC picked me up, and from then on it was smooth sailing. Any more to say would be just details of a long, long stretch of hard work and a lot of good results.
Well, they had a lot of great musicians on some of those radio shows, didn't they?
Oh, indeed. Well, I played quite a few radio shows after that with Gene Golkett again on the Mallory Hat Hour, I recall, and several others. I don't recall them all right now.
I suppose when you was at the Hotel Astor, you said was what we'd call our cocktail room?
Yes, it was a dinner room. Actually, it was more or less it wasn't a cocktail room. No, it was a dinner room. Yeah.
You were more or less a troubadour from Texas, then.
Yeah, correct.
Did you do many of the society dates with Myra Davis?
Oh,
where
yes,
they
yes. would
play the society balls.
Yes. We would have a double band. We would have two of everything.
Continuous music.
Just enormous. Continuous music. An enormous band when they didn't need half of them, but just for the splurge, they'd have 40 men, and they'd be... Everybody would be doubling up on everybody else.
Be all white tie and tail paradise.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Well, I bet you some big times.
Well, at any rate, I was glad to get out of that portion of it, and I was glad to lay down the banjo, so to say, and pick up the baton, because I'd had my day anyway, all through school, and Jimmy's Joys, you remember them, don't you?
Oh, sure, I've got some of the best jazz records, Jimmy Joys, he made on OK before he started recording the sweet music.
You ought to have the record we made in California in 1900 and something or other, I can't remember the date.
Oh, Jimmy Maloney was his name.
Yeah, sure, from Commerce.
Yeah, and, yeah. But, boy, back in those days, did the musicians really look on a recording date with a lot of anticipation, or was it just another job?
Oh, that was the greatest thing in the world, to be able to make a record.
Boy, what?
To make a record, to get on record would be something. Yeah. We had this man in California. I don't know how he had fell heir to the recording equipment, but nevertheless he had it. And we made some records that we were so proud of, and they're probably the stinkiest things anybody ever listened to. Because, you know, we copied everybody else in that time. We copied Whiteman, we copied all the top bands that we heard on record. So we wanted to get on record.
Well, that's the way over in England, all the jazz musicians, they copied, listened to records and copied the... But I'm glad to hear you say that about records, because I've heard other musicians say that they would act like they were just doing somebody a favor when they dropped by the studio to make a recording.
Well,
and
I don't think that they told you the truth, really. They not only got well paid for it, but they got a kick out of it, because they were always either exceptional arrangements, other than the studio dates where you just played this song or that song just to get into the flow of records for people to buy generally, just to have some music. But they got a kick out of it. Don't think they didn't.
Was Ben Pollock a good man to work with?
He was terrific. Ben was a wonderful guy. He's a very sweet disposition. And one of the greatest drummers in the world. He should never stop playing the drums to lead a band, because when I played with him, he played the drums, and boy, he played them, and he carried us all along with him tremendously.
He must have been a good fellow, because he certainly gave some great musicians their start, and they all seemed to like him.
Yeah, he did. And another he gave a start to was a man named Glenn Miller. But that's a long story, but I better not tell you
that. Yeah, and Goodman, too?
No, we brought Glenn Miller down to Austin University.
You did?
To play with Jimmy Joyce. And he couldn't play well enough, and we had to tell him and send him back to Colorado.
And Glenn Miller made a date at Austin with Jimmy Joyce.
Oh, indeed. He came down to go to school, but he had to work his way through. So when he couldn't play well enough, and he couldn't, I'll tell you this, I know, we sent him back to Colorado. And in later years, he, in the meantime, he studied counterpoint and harmony and whatnot, and worked on his instrument, went to California, and joined Ben Pollock.
Well, do you think that Victor Young had any influence on Glenn Miller when he was in California in those early days?
Well, no, because Victor wasn't even in California then. He was in New York. No, I don't think so.
Who would you say was the best arranger back in those days that you can remember working with?
Well, there were quite a few. There were some outstanding guys. You ask me, and I can't tell you the name now.
This Rube Crozier that you mentioned.
Well, Rube Crozier was fine. Of course, Whiteman had him under contract, and... I can't think of the boy's name, but it was also very fine.
Did you know Ferdy Groffay?
Very well.
Was he an arranger?
Very fine.
That's
and
what I...
also a writer.
Smith, on those recording dates, the musicians, did they get royalties on those records, or was it mostly just paid for the session?
Well, they were paid a flat amount for a session. And as I recall... I don't know. It depended on the musician. If he was one of the top guys, he had his own price, really. And the studios knew that. They didn't call him unless they expected to pay him his price. But the average call for a musician was about $25 a session, 3-hour session from 9 to 12.
What was the scale in those days?
I don't know what the scale was. I'm sure it was within that range, anyway.
What was the price of booze?
Price of boots?
Booze.
Those? I never bought it in my
booze. I thought maybe you didn't know the price of the scale. You didn't remember the price of booze. Well,
anyway, you're talking about prohibition time, so whatever you bought was worth a heck of a lot more than you can buy it now.
Well, I might have one of the troubles with a lot of them that you mentioned. They didn't have to pay anything for the booze, and that's the reason they're not around like you are today. They could drink too much of it.
Well, it could be. White's was one of the most beautiful places that anybody could ever expect to see. And it was a pity and an absolute horrible thing to know what happened to the White brothers. There were five of them who opened that restaurant. Though it was on a lower level from the street, it was the most attractive, beautiful place you can imagine, and they had three floors under it with their own bakeries, with their own refrigeration, their own they had everything there. They had been quite successful down in the financial district, just serving lunch to all the top people in Wall Street. And of course, they opened this in the Roaring Twenties when the money was free and whatnot. And we just had a lovely clientele, all the people from Westchester who would meet their wives there, for instance, would come down for an evening to the theater and whatnot. And the food was out of this world.
Did you have a band there?
Oh, yeah. Well, in D.C., sure.
Was that George White? Was he one of them?
No.
That was different to White?
No. These were just four, five Kansas boys who went to New York and made good. They ended up killing themselves, each one of them. When the market broke in 29, they were so deep in the market and also with this $3 million restaurant that they went under like nobody.
Well, we're all lucky, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Mr. Blue, I have a record here that I found. I guess I went through about 10,000 records to find this particular record. I found it in an old jukebox stock. It's by Glenn Miller. Glenn Miller's orchestra on the Blue Wax Columbia.
Yeah.
I wish you'd tell me something about this when you made this record with Mr. Miller, because I noticed it has a vocal refrain by Smith Blue.
Well, that's an interesting story back of the record. It's actually my orchestra, and Glenn made an arrangement that he was real proud of, and so was I, and he said, could I hire a couple of symphony men, oboes and bassoons and whatnot, for a special arrangement? I said, well, of course. And we made the record, and when it was finished, I liked it so well that I said, well, why don't we put your name on it? It doesn't mean anything to me, and it might be a help to you. And this is the first record that Glenn Miller ever had his name on.
You certainly did a fine job on it, Mr. Blue. And while I'm saying these few words here, I'd like to say that I think I can speak for other collectors all over the United States, and we're really grateful to have fine vocalists like you around to have these records that you've made to enjoy.
What was the approximate date on that record?
Okay, you
haunted night upon my pillow, mournful at a weeping willow, haunted by my sorrow.
The date of the record, I believe, was somewhere around 1932, late 32 or early 33. It's one of the last records that I made with the orchestra that I was so fond of, and it was such a tremendous orchestra, the best I ever had.
Was it recorded in New York?
It was recorded in New York at Columbia Studios. The first side that you will hear is Moonlight Serenade.
That was played for the Moonlight Orchestra.
And the other side
when this is finished, will be Moonlight on the Ganges. And I might say something about this record. I'm sure that you will enjoy the passage by Bunny Berrigan himself.
And the person that we've been looking forward to seeing for the past 2 months has finally showed up. Smith Ballou from Fort Worth, along with Mary, his wife, stopped in the temple and picked up Olin Carver and brought him. We're going to have a real recording session, take up where we left off down at temple. Smith, we're glad to see you.
Thank you, Tommy. It's a pleasure to be here, I assure you. This outhouse, as you call it, is anything but that. It certainly is attractive, and the equipment is beyond anything you could think of. It's just perfect. Now, what are we going to do first?
Well, we're going to put this Hal Kemp record that you're doing the lead off with it, and then we're going to tape your collection of records and let you pick them as you want them recorded. And I thought it'd be nice to end up with that transcription that was made for the from the Texas Centennial. And we'll all talk on it. We'll just have a good time like we had down at the temple. And maybe if you get feeling good enough, you might even sing a note or two before it's over.
I don't know. Perhaps I will. I'll try. Well, this is a Brunswick record that I don't recall making with Hal Kemp.
Was Skinny Ennis with the band then?
Yes. Yes, he was, indeed. But I know at the same time, about this time, Hal Kemp got an engagement at the Orpheum in Brooklyn and insisted that I sing with him there, which I did for that week. This is about the same time.
What year?
Oh, 1929, I'd say. Something like that.
That's a good year.
And it's called I Remember You from Somewhere.
Well, Smith, here's a record on Columbia, 9 Little Miles from 1010 Tennessee. Did you do this before or after that you made? This is with your own orchestra, incidentally. Did you do this before or after that you made the session with Ellington?
It was after the session with Ellington, yes. This was later, probably a month later.
Do you recall any of the personnel?
Oh, yes, yes, I do. I had my regular band augmented with people like Manny Klein, who has a passage, and also Joe Venuti.
Well, it's one of our favorite records, and I know it was a favorite of a lot of people. Harvey, let's hear it. I think we recorded this down at Olin's house. Howard, would you like to record it and put it on this tape? Smith, let's go ahead and put it on here.
This is a mellotone.
Smith Ballou and his orchestra of the Champagne Waltz.
Yes, and I think we recorded it on a tempo.
Well, it's pretty, and it might be a better copy. Let's put
all
it
right,
on.
All right, fine.
The side is Play to Me Gypsy.
Yes, I think I recall that we recorded this at Temple. We've got it on tape already, but if you wish, we'll put it on this.
Let's put it on again. Smith, here's my pan of Troubadours record on Columbia with Sam Lannon, the director.
You probably remember that he directed a mini orchestra. Thank you for the coffee, Louise.
Oh, yeah.
I tried. We tried together.
We tried.
You remember Sam Lanning?
Oh, very well. And I think I'm playing banjo on this record. I'm not certain.
Well, you probably are, because if I understand right, Sam was a man who liked to save money. And he would do that. The title, my strongest weakness is you.
Well, now, wait a minute. If this is the one I'm thinking of, there's a little story back of it. Sam was playing at the, not the Steel Pier, what's the other one in Atlantic City?
I can't.
Oh, don't you know? Next to the Steel Pier. Well, anyway, Sam was playing there, I was playing with him, and we spent one weekend driving to New York to make some records. And whether this is one, I'm not certain that this is the one, but it could be.
And you think you played banjo?
Yes, I think I probably did. I probably don't know whether I can tell or not.
Was you playing banjo at Atlantic City with him?
Oh, yes, you bet. Well, the orchestra had Dorsey Brothers, and they had Charlie Jandro, a drummer that killed himself later. They had, the original Memphis Five trumpet player. What's his name? Tell me quick. He was in the band, nevertheless. Quite a fine band, I'll tell you that. Excellent band.
Isn't that all one? Phil Napoli?
Yes, Phil Napoli.
Phil Napoli.
Yeah. This may be it.
What kind of a fellow was Sam Lanning to work for?
Wonderful. I liked him very much, and he was quite interested in my career, and he gave me a lot of good information, a lot of good advice, really. I spent a lot of time with him on the beach talking about how I could make more money and what I could do to better myself, and he just gave me a lot of good advice.
He was a good, sound businessman. He was responsible for a lot of recordings. Do you recall this Ipana Troubadours now?
Oh, yeah.
Evidently, there was an Ipana toothpaste radio show, wasn't there?
That's exactly where he carried the name from, that show that he had for quite some time. Now, I wasn't on that show with him. I didn't play with him then.
Evidently, he knew more about music than Ed Kirkby.
Oh, there's no question about it. He was a good musician. I don't know what instrument he played. Of course, he conducted, and I just don't know what he played. I believe he played the clarinet, though. I'm not sure.
How was Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey along that period?
They were wild as bucks, both of them. And when we went up to New York to do these recordings on that weekend, they spent most of the time smoking marijuana. And I tried it. I thought I might as well try and see what it was like. But it never did anything to me. I didn't know how to use it. I didn't.
In other words, it didn't send you.
No, it didn't send me at all.
Well, you was lucky.
Yeah. So that's the story of this record now, if it is the record.
Well, if it's not, it's the same story that other records like it that you made with Sam Lanning.
True.
Let's hear this Ipana Troubadours recording. Smith, now that you've heard that recording, do you recognize any of the musicians, especially the banjo player?
Well, yeah, I think that was me. It sounded kind of like my little old strumming that I did many strums through the years. And I particularly like Tommy's little passage and also Phil Napoleon's.
Did you say
Arthur Shutt on the piano was terrific.
I didn't know that he had a drinking problem until you told me down there at Temple.
Oh, yes. He went from worse to worse to worse. You couldn't imagine.
Now, Pat's Waller drank a lot, but evidently he could handle his, couldn't he? Or didn't he never was
No, Arthur Shutt was a terrifically emotional person. That's why he played such marvelous piano.
Was he a moody
person? Oh, extremely moody. extremely brilliant.
Fats wasn't.
No, just anything would go with him. Yeah, didn't bother him.
Well, we come to another Ted Wallace recording now on Columbia, which was Ed Kirkby. You recall those two signs?
Oh, Sweetheart's Holiday. Yes, I kind of remember that. This might be a trio, I'm not sure. Because he used a trio a lot in which I sang the melody, of course.
Huggable, Kissable, You on the Flip.
Well, I don't really recall.
Let's play them and see. And if it's not you, it was probably Ted Wallace trying to sing. But let's put it on there because it brings back memories all the
time. Yeah, I think I remember Sweetheart's Holiday.
All right, let's play it.